You may proceed.
Good morning, Justices. My name is Louis Antonacci, and I represent the plaintiff appellant of Evans Sun Construction in this appeal. May it please the court, my client appeals to Arlington County Circuit Court Judge Dan Fiore, setting aside the jury's $71,500 verdict in favor of Medlin and further reversing Arlington County Circuit Court Judge Luis DiMatteo's ruling on plea and bar that TMG's purported releases are not, in fact, clear and unambiguous on their face and thus do not bar Medlin's claims as a matter of law. As this court is aware, this case arises out of a construction project for the renovation of Highview Park in Arlington County, Virginia. The appellee defendant, Matthews Group, or TMG, was the general contractor on that project, and my client, Medlin & Son, was a concrete subcontractor. There is no dispute that TMG terribly mismanaged this project and was thus continually adding and changing Medlin's work requirements on an ongoing basis as the project progressed. There is also no dispute that Medlin, the concrete subcontractor, stepped up to the challenge and performed all the additional work ordered by TMG throughout the project. There is also no dispute that Highview Park, enjoyed by countless Arlington families, opened on time as a direct result of Medlin's commitment to getting the job done, despite TMG's undisputed mismanagement. There is also no dispute that Arlington County paid TMG over $440,000 for acting as general contractor on this project, although it did no real work itself. And there is no dispute that while Medlin performed work on this project until May 7, 2013, TMG has not paid Medlin even one dime since March of 2013, and Medlin had numerous unpaid outstanding invoices as of the date of this last payment by TMG. TMG admits that
May I interrupt you for just a minute? Would you mind briefly focusing on assignment of error 4 and invoice 627?
Sure. Okay, so that invoice, so there seemed to be a misunderstanding with the trial court there, with the trial judge. Judge Fiore seemed to indicate that I had somehow indicated to him at some point early in the trial that invoice, separate and apart from all the other invoices in the case, was specially submitted only as to the quantum merit claim and not as to the breach of contract claim. Although I think that...
But you caved on the quantum merit claim if it were included, right? In other words, if you were to lose on invoice 627 on express contract, you did cave that you don't have a fallback quantum merit claim.
The trial judge ultimately, initially I had said that there was a basis for a quantum merit claim, that we weren't proceeding on a quantum merit claim, but we changed position after the first day of trial, and that Judge Fiore indicated that he was not going to enter a consent judge order if there was an objection. And I indicated that there was an objection, and he ultimately, after the defendant closed their case, struck the quantum merit claim. I'm not conceding that point, though. I believe that there is evidence of reasonableness of the value of Medlin's work in the record.
So on assignment 4, your remedy that I think you're asking for is a remand for retrial on that issue.
Yeah. No, well, not on that issue, no, Your Honor. It's really on... So Judge Gray held that the... that invoice 627, because he struck it, because the final release acted as a complete bar to all future claims after March 29th, and that invoice was submitted April 16th, I believe it was, because he had struck that invoice, that there was no claim for breach of contract after March 29th, which I thought was just wrong. So that's the point I'm making. So if the court upheld the releases ruling, I believe that if the court erred in striking. It is Medlin's position that the court erred in striking invoice number 627, and the case should be remanded for retrial as to breach of contract on that invoice for damages. I'm picking up where I left off. I was saying that TMG even admits that to this day, 3.5 years later, it still owes Medlin at least $15,000 under what it advances as the sole memorial of the subcontract between the parties. And most importantly, there is no dispute that after a three-day trial, an Arlington County jury found, after less than 3 hours of deliberation, that TMG breached its contract with Medlin, failing to pay Medlin $71,500 for work that Medlin performed on the Ivy Park project. As this court is aware, the standard of review for a motion to strike or a motion for summary judgment and a motion to set aside the verdict are all basically the same. That is, that if there is any evidence in the record supporting the verdict, that the verdict must be sustained. And this court's review of a motion to set aside a verdict or any of those motions is essentially the same, too. So the recipient of the verdict, that is Medlin in this case, gets the benefit of any conflict in the evidence, as well as any and all inferences which may be drawn from the evidence. And this court will also consider under Williams v. Condit all the evidence in the record, including evidence presented by the defendant. And all of that evidence, the plaintiff, the recipient of the verdict, Medlin, gets the benefit of all any conflicts and as well as any inferences may be drawn.
If I may I interrupt you again? Would you also briefly address the cross error on the assertion that the damages were inherently speculative?
Yes. So this is an interesting issue because while these damages are unliquidated in a sense, they are really sort of liquidated damages because while liquidated damages are generally understood to be a term of a contract where if you breach the contract by not, say, for example, delivering a product on time, then the damages will be liquidated at X amount per day, and those are liquidated damages. In this case, however, so my client agreed to perform work on this project for a certain price. And so TMG, the counterparty's obligation under this contract, was simply to pay Medlin the amount of money it had agreed to pay. So the damages are, in that sense, already liquidated. So if you look at it, either way you look at it, if you look at it from an unliquidated damages perspective, then the way to determine what the actual damages are is to determine what amount of money would put the non-breaching party in the position it would have been if the breaching party had performed. In this case, it's whatever TMG had promised to pay Medlin for the work it performed. There's no dispute, absolutely no dispute, that Medlin performed the work, and Arlington County even praised Medlin's work on this project. So, from that perspective, Medlin's damages are not speculative at all.
Well, the basis for the damages was you agreed to pay X amount for this work. Here's the invoices that show in some detail what the work was done and the amounts due. And so that's the amount that was due. Now, the fact that the jury gave you a haircut on your damages, that doesn't make your claim speculative. They're all just based on the invoices and what was promised. Is that correct?
By the degrees, Your Honor.
All right.
So, addressing the damages issue.
No, you've addressed it. You can move on. Thank you.
So, as I was saying, so because Medlin gets the benefit of all the doubt in the record, Medlin had, there was ample testimony that from numerous parties that, well, not from numerous parties, from numerous individuals, that there were numerous oral contracts proceeding because this project was so poorly managed by TMG, that there were numerous contracts executed, oral contracts on a daily basis, between an authorized TMG representative and my client's representative, James Medlin. They agreed to the work to be performed, the amount that TMG would pay Medlin. Medlin would perform the work. This individual, TMG representative, his name is Lloyd Sags, would call James Medlin's wife, tell her exactly what to put in the invoice. She would submit it to TMG, and they would get paid. And this is how things went throughout the course of the project. So the jury rightly found evidence of those contracts, and because they rendered a verdict in favor of Medlin, this court should uphold that verdict. With regard to the releases, the trial court put its entire ruling, or based its entire ruling on these releases that were submitted by TMG. Now, at the outset, I would say that the law of the case precluded the trial court from basically ruling against Judge DiMatteo on that issue, an earlier plea embargo.
So a trial judge can't change his or her mind while the case is proceeding?
A trial judge could change his or her mind, I would say. But when you had an earlier ruling on plea embargo where evidence was presented, the releases were presented, James Medlin testified, Joe Matthews testified, Gail Medlin testified, and Judge DiMatteo said, you know what, these releases are not unambiguous. This has to go before the trier of fact, and they need to very need to determine, you know, what he knew. If there's any way we're going to has to be known voluntarily.
But do we really want to tell trial judges if you make the first call and you later conclude, gee, I really messed that up, you don't have the power to reconsider it?
Well, in this case, this is a different judge, and this is a different part of the case. When you have an earlier judge saying, from the standpoint of judicial economy, I would actually argue that point. When you have a plea embargo at a preliminary stage in the case, this was 6 months before 5 months before the...
But I get judicial economy, and judges that show up on other judges' cases know that principle well, but the question now is power. Does a later judge have the power to reconsider?
I would say that this court, that no, because the state courts of Virginia should be guided by the Fourth Circuit and the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court of the United States in this regard, that they should look at the ever...
No, generally we're guided by ourselves on matters of state law.
Of course, Your Honor. But again, I think that the court should be guided at least by the discretion to look at the Everett factors, which are whether or not a subsequent trial has brought new facts into evidence, whether or not the controlling precedent had changed, or whether or not the earlier court's ruling would work manifest injustice. And none of those factors apply here, and I think that clearly because, I mean, TMG admits that it completely stiffed Medlin on the last 2 months of the, 2 months of the job, Judge Fiore's ruling works manifest injustice, not Judge DiMatteo's.
Now, let me get this correct. You're maintaining that this court should be controlled by the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals and the United States Supreme Court on matters of state civil procedure?
I believe that this is from an Erie perspective, Your Honor. I believe that this goes pretty close to the substantive rights of the parties as opposed to a purely procedural issue. So, even if this court...
Well, you've got it backwards. In Erie, in a diversity case, the federal court is constitutionally obligated to follow the state court's interpretation of the state court principle. There's no reverse Erie doctrine, at least under our Constitution.
No, you're correct about that, Your Honor. My point is that this court and the trial court should be guided by the principles set forth in Erie and set forth in Everett and Christensen.
You can press on. Your main point is that the course of dealing suggested an alternative way of understanding these releases.
Yes.
Now, there is evidence on, speaking of the releases, there is evidence about invoice 593 being paid after the release was signed.
Right.
And then there's invoice 627 that was submitted again after. Is there any other evidence of payments made on a particular invoice after the release was signed, or is it those two?
Those two, and it's important, I think, that those were both the final releases, the same release that the court issued in this case to act as an absolute bar. And this is the same project, and just a few months later, so a clear contemporaneous course of dealing with the parties. I'd like to reserve the balance of my time.
May I ask one question? As I understand their argument, I think you responded to Justice Kelsey's question with regard to the course of dealing. Perhaps putting a different interpretation on this release. But if you read the release first and you determine that the release is not ambiguous, going with the last judge's ruling, would you ever get to course of dealing if that would tend to contradict this release?
So if the release is clear and ambiguous, do you get to course of dealing?
Yes.
Is that what you're asking? I think in this case you would, Your Honor, particularly when you have a number of factors where the project was mismanaged, the contract was a sort of dynamic contract, changing on a daily basis, and you had a clear course of dealing here where both, as you said...
That gets you back to course of dealing. If, as the judge ruled, this is unambiguous and this is a final release, then why would the court be incorrect that we don't even consider course of dealing?
Well, I mean, if you're saying that, yeah, I mean, if the ruling is that it is clearly unambiguous, then you wouldn't get to course of dealing. But I do argue that it is ambiguous because, as the trial court even indicated, it is titled the release of lien, and then goes on to say you're releasing everything under the sun. And anyone who has any experience in real estate,
you may save your time. I think I understand your argument.
Okay, thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Matt Ravencraft, and I represent the appellee in this case, the Matthews Group, Inc., trading as TMG Construction Corporation. The key issue for consideration in this case and for this appeal is whether the trial court erred or committed reversible error when it granted TMG's motion to strike motion for summary judgment and set aside the jury's verdict. Under well-settled principles, the jury's verdict should not be set aside unless the trial court determines that it is plainly wrong, that is contrary to the law, or there is no credible evidence to support that verdict. I suggest to this court that the trial court was correct in setting aside the jury verdict in this case.
May I ask you this? In the two delivery order authorizations, 187 and 189, are there any clauses in either of those two documents that would qualify as a merger or integration clause?
I believe there is, Your Honors. And it's in the top of the first page of those documents, which identifies the agreement as to scope, schedule, and amount. And the language that I specifically refer to is it states, in accordance with all terms and conditions of the master agreement and amendments, this DOA and other changes agreed to in writing in the future between the subcontractor, Medlin in this case, and TMG. And the evidence here, Your Honor, is...
Can I pause you for a second? I saw that, but I read that as a change order clause. Integration or merger clause says, look, this is the document. That we have no other deals. Don't talk about side deals. Don't talk about oral deals. Don't talk about amendments. A change order clause is a lesser version of that, a big lesser version of that, which is, well, we may have other deals and other things, but for this deal, if you want to change this particular deal, we have to have a written change order, and here's the process we go through.
That's right.
Okay, so is that clause you're mentioning really just a change order clause, which would not have the effect of wiping out collateral agreements as a matter of law?
No. And the reason why is because that change order clause that you're referring to here is not merely a change order clause. It contemplates that the change orders must be agreed to in writing by the parties.
Within the scope of the DOA.
That's correct, Your Honor. That's correct. And the evidence here is that there were change orders agreed to in writing by the parties, and that they did adjust the scope of the DOA, and that the scope was adjusted to include every single item of additional work that Medlin maintains was not within the scope of the DOAs. If you look, the two original subcontracts were each represented by an original DOA. DOA for job number 187 and DOA for job 189. Both of those DOAs included two separate change orders to the DOAs. For subcontract number one, there was a DOA change order, or DOA CO number one, and a DOA CO number two, both agreed to in writing by the parties, both set forth the additional scope of work and the amount that work would TMG would pay for that work. Same thing happened in the second subcontract, but
can't a party then come in and say, okay, yeah, that was the written contract. That's not how we did business for an extended period of time. We would get on the phone, things would change on the ground, something would happen, they would need help, we would provide that help. It was all done more informally, and we would invoice it, that always got paid. So why can't that the jury consider that course of dealing and course of performance?
Your Honor, that is the embodiment of parole evidence. Inadmissible parole evidence. Because what the evidence shows here in this case, that argument, if Medlin advanced that argument, it would have traction if all of the oral promises and agreements that were purportedly made between my clients occurred after these DOAs were signed. The evidence was clear and undisputed on this point. James Medlin at trial specifically acknowledged and testified that all of the purported oral agreements whereby their claims for additional work arose occurred prior to these DOAs being drafted, prior to these DOAs and the change orders thereto being submitted to Medlin, and prior to Medlin actually signing off on these DOAs, which identify the definitive scope of work as modified throughout the course of the job. It's every single claim that Medlin asserted in this case bucks every written agreement that Medlin signed and every written release that Medlin signed. 10 times, there's 10 separate subcontract documents, change orders, and final and partial releases that were all signed by Medlin that acknowledge the written contractual obligations between the parties, and yet at trial they backpedal from those written documents and say, notwithstanding that you paid us for 95% of the work that we've agreed to perform in writing as progressing throughout the terms of this contract and throughout the terms of this project, now, because of prior oral agreements that were made, side deals presumably made between my client's project manager and Medlin at the job site before the job was done, I'm entitled to claim more than $136,000 for work that I agreed to perform for $120,000.
But tell me if I'm missing the logic of what you just said. You have the prior oral agreements, you have the DOAs after that, right?
That's correct.
You don't have a merger integration clause, but you do have a written change order clause. All right. I'm not sure how that helps you, because the merger integration clause would hose down all of the prior oral agreements that were still executory agreements. A mere change order clause wouldn't have that reach under general contract principles.
Well, here's the answer to that, Your Honor. And the answer to that is that I invite the court to take a look at the scope of work, the actual scope of work that is defined in all of the writings. And the actual scope of work that is defined in all of the writings incorporates every single item of work that Medlin now claims they agreed to, that was the subject of the oral promises and oral agreements between the
Well, this may be very difficult to do, but actually I have a chart of exactly that I'm looking at, and it appears to show me that there were lots of things that were actually accomplished that were arguably outside the scope of the two DOAs. Power washing, seal coating, backhoe rentals, fabric and stone for drainage, back walls. I mean, we'd take an hour and a half to go through all this. But the moment the side deal is not clearly subsetted within the DOA, and it preceded the DOA, and the DOA has no integration clause or merger clause, why doesn't the side deal continue unaffected by the language of the DOA?
Again, I think it's because it's parole evidence, an inadmissible parole evidence. Just because there's
to vary the terms of the contract.
To vary the terms of the contract. To your point, Your Honor, if there are discrete items of additional work that never made it into the written DOAs, for example, the plumbing work that you referenced, that would be an additional, that would be supplemental to the written contracts. That would be supplemental terms.
So would
that
not,
they would be entitled to payment for if they were able to prove their damages with respect to those discrete items.
But that's a heck of a concession. I hope you thought it through, because that confirms the absence of a merger integration clause permits the allowance of pre-existing collateral oral agreements.
Well, I think that's the parole evidence rule, Your Honor, in a nutshell. I mean, the parole evidence rule is not parole evidence is not admissible in order to vary or contradict the terms of a prior or contemporaneous oral agreements is not admissible to vary or contradict the terms of an integrated written agreement. But parole evidence is admissible in order to supplement those terms where there's no integration clause, like Your Honor is suggesting. I believe that there is an integration clause here, maybe inartfully written, but in any event, if Your Honor was suggesting that that the parole evidence of oral agreements is admissible, it is only admissible in the context of showing what additional work over and above what the written contract says, what was agreed upon. Not to vary or contradict what the written term said.
Counsel.
Yes.
You know, sometimes I'm a little overly simplistic. I default back to being a country lawyer from Leesburg. The two DOAs are to do contract, are to do concrete work. Is that right?
Well, the original scope of those is identified in Exhibit A to the DOAs. The two initial DOAs are the best way to describe it is in the appendix.
Essentially, let's just cut.
Yes.
Essentially,
sir.
It's concrete,
yes,
concrete and related work to that. Right, that's what they contract.
The specific scope of work, Your Honor, is referenced in Exhibit A to those DOAs. One of them was to place install 3,000 square feet of concrete sidewalk.
I don't want to take up all the rest of your time. I've got these in.
Yes, Your Honor.
Essentially,
original DOAs was for concrete work.
Now, you had a project manager who had worked with Evelyn for many years on various jobs. And their testimony is that your project manager asked them, in order to help the project manager, who was your agent, asked them to help with things such as removing dirt, digging trenches, putting in drains for the plumbing contractor, installing and painting railings, fencing, and placing topsoil. Is it your position that your project manager did not ask for that, or that your project manager asked for it, but they didn't do it, or that your project manager had gone rogue on you and that you had no knowledge whatsoever that they were out there doing these things, or that in fact all of that was done, all of that added value, but based upon the fact that it's parole evidence, can't be before the court? Which path did you take?
Actually, neither, or none. My position is that yes, there was my project manager or TMG's project manager did in fact request that additional work be done, including painting the handrails. All of the additional work is described by Medlin, and every single request for additional work was included into a DOA change order, a written change order, and identified in Exhibit A to those DOA change orders as additional scopes of work that are to be performed by Medlin and Son for an agreed upon price that is reflected in each of those written DOAs.
And so their testimony is there was a whole lot that wasn't reflected in those DOAs, and your testimony is no, that they're making that up.
That's correct. They're saying that there was a whole lot more than what was reflected in the DOAs, but there was never any proof of anything more than what was already incorporated into the DOAs, billed for by pursuant to the DOAs, paid for by my client pursuant to those DOAs, and released.
Apparently there was proof of that. There was testimony in their case in chief to that effect.
I don't believe there was, Your Honor. The testimony itself, Mr. Medlin, identified items such as the ones that you... And I see my time is about
you
up.
You may answer the question.
Yeah, but... But the items that the testimony at trial was was from Mr. Medlin as to the additional items of work that were performed. And Mr. Medlin testified that the additional items of work were core drilling holes for installing railings, removing temporary fences, hauling trash, hauling debris, removing of topsoil, spreading of topsoil, seeding and strawing, and I believe that's all. I believe there's painting of handrails. Every single one of those items, every single one of those items of purported additional work is incorporated into the written DOAs and written change orders that my project manager drew up after he agreed and requested that he perform this additional work.
Okay. Thank you. Your time has expired.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Rebuttal, you have 45 seconds.
Can I take up your 45 seconds? The summary of damages exhibit, which begins with invoice 602 and ends with invoice 624, there are eight of them. Are they included within or not included within the DOA change orders for purposes of payment?
I'm not sure I understand the question.
Respond to the most recent remark made by your opposing counsel.
So those items, yes, that's what I was going to do. So if you look at the not only James Medlin's testimony, but also the request for admission that I propounded on the TMG, I basically took those from their daily field reports. And as I think you indicated, many of those items do not appear anywhere in the DOAs that TMG submitted. And again, this is a fact question that the jury decided in favor of Medlin, and Medlin should get the benefit of any conflicts of the evidence as the recipient of the verdict. Thank you.
All right. Call the next case.